Anyway, so we're going to talk about that because your greatest adventures sometimes begin with a single choice between two paths. And I know that sometimes this sounds dramatic, you know, but we don't always get that dramatic moment in the Alamo where they draw a line in the sand and you step across that line or not, you know. Of course, those are those dramatic life-defining moments. But there are a lot of life-defining moments that kind of sneak up on us sometimes, and they happen, and we choose without even knowing that it's going to change our lives. And that's what I want to talk about, because we don't want that to happen. We don't want you to be faced with this life-defining moment of a choice and not know, oh, that was a life-defining moment. That changed my life. We kind of want to know that going in. Now, not everything is. So how do you know when you are facing a life-defining moment? Because not everything is. Paper, plastic, probably not going to matter. Extra crispy or original recipe, probably just a pack of you that day. You know, these aren't always life-defining choices. How do you know when the choice before you is going to be one of those? So I'm going to give you a hint on that, a formula, or however you want to look at it, on how you can know this. And I want you to understand that this also will help you decide it. So this kind of formula has many purposes. The first thing that you have to understand is, does the choice affect your relationship with the living God? Because if the answer to that question is yes, then you are facing a life-defining moment. Because all that really matters is what our relationship is with God. But we make decisions all the time that impact that without realizing it. Let me give you some examples. So buying a car. Now, that doesn't seem like a life-defining moment necessarily. It doesn't have to be. And for some people, by the way, it isn't. It absolutely isn't. Depends on where you are in life. Some people go out and buy a car and not think twice about it, whether they're Christian or not. I'm not in that category. I'm so poor that when I go to buy a car, I borrow money to do it. And therefore, things start changing in the transaction. I'm not talking about whether I chose the gray Jeep or the black Jeep. You know, that I don't think God cares what color of Jeep I have. I'm talking about the decision to do it to begin with. Because if you go out to buy a new car, like if I decided, you know, I'm in a midlife crisis, which, you know, I'm probably past that point in my life right now, but if I was in a late midlife crisis and I decided I was going to go out and buy a sports car or something, I don't have the money for that. So I'd go out and buy it, and now that money has to come from somewhere. Well, let me tell you where it's not coming from. It's not coming from your tax money, because the government always gets its tax money, right? It's not coming probably from your rent or your mortgage, because you got to live, food, got to do that. Credit card companies pretty good, you get their money too. So when you start divvying up all the money that you're spending on other things, now this extra payment of a car takes out a chunk of it. Guess where that comes from? Oftentimes. In fact, I'd say usually. It comes from the money that you should have given to God. You know, God tells us first fruits go to him. And so that money we don't have anymore to give you. Sorry, God, we're out of money this month. You know, we look at the bank account, I don't have any money. I can't. I meet people all the time, say, I can't give any money. I don't have it. That's because of previous life-defining choices that have taken that money from them. And so now they're in a situation where they're not obeying God because, well, I can't afford to. And that's going to impact your relationship with the living God. Jesus says that. He says you can't love God and money. You have to choose. And your heart follows your treasure. So wherever you put your treasure, in a new car, that's where your heart is. And ever see anybody with a new car? You know, you can tell that's where their heart is. They wash it all the time. You know, they wax it. You know, I never wash a car except when it's new. Those first couple of weeks, man, I'm washing that car. My wife's, I don't know who you are. Well, that's my new car. And after a while, it's my old car, and I don't wash it anymore. But that's what happens. You can tell where your heart is because that's where your treasure went. And so that can actually define you. There are other questions that we face and decisions which obviously impact us, like getting married. I promise you the person you marry will impact your relationship with God. And if you don't believe me, talk to somebody who married an unbeliever or just married someone from a different religion. Just find out how that worked out for them, how that impacted their lives all over the place. Are you going to be closer to God after the marriage or not? These questions we don't usually ask. We ask questions like, do I love them? You know, can he provide? Can she cook? You know, they kind of look hot. You know, all these questions go through our mind. We never ask ourselves, how is this going to impact my life with God? Is this going to come between it? Is it going to pull me away from it? There are people not here today because they got in a relationship with somebody that pulled them away from God. And in fact, I would say, you know, we talk about this, that about 90% of the people who've left Spirit Chapel have left because of something good that happened in their life. You know, they got married, they got engaged to somebody new, they bought a new house, you know, they got a new job, and all of a sudden, psh, they're gone. And it'd be okay if they're going somewhere else, I'm okay with that, but oftentimes they're not. Now they're just not, they're not coming together in a body of believers. They don't know any Christian people. They're caught up in this world. It has taken them away. And so that's what I want to talk about, because we come up to these moments and we have to know, we have to look for God behind the decision. We have to, or else these decisions will catch us off guard and it'll take us away from the one we should be closer to. Every decision is supposed to move us closer to God. I'm going to talk today about two women who had this kind of a choice, and one took a decision that took her away from God, and one took a decision that took her to God. Here's what you need to know. It looked at the moment of decision that the woman who chose to go away from God made the right choice, and the woman who chose the other path made the wrong choice. It'll look like that, because this person initially seemed to just make the right choice. And this person seemed to have chosen a completely different path. Let me get into it. Okay, so it came about in the days the judges governed that there was a famine in the land. We talked about this last week. That's the promised land. There's a famine in. How could there be a famine in a promised land, you ask? Go online. The sermon's up there. All right, that's what we talked about last week. A certain man of Bethlehem in Judah then went to sojourn in the land of Moab. In other words, the rain stopped coming, and this guy said, psh, I'm out. It's a promised land, but I'm leaving. I'm picking up my pack, packing everybody up, and I'm leaving. Now, then it tells us his name. The name of this man was Elimelech. You don't have to worry about that, because next week you will never hear about him again. The name of his wife was Naomi. Remember that name. We'll come back to it, because she does show up for the rest of the book. Naomi, by the way, is Hebrew for pleasant. So she must have been a pleasant person. In Hebrew culture, oftentimes people get named after their characteristics. They would even change their name to fit their characteristics. You'll find this throughout the Bible. So this, she must have been a very pleasant person at first. And the names of the two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. Now, there's some question about what these names mean, but it seems like they mean sickness and weak. So that's probably not a very good thing to name kids, but probably they had issues kind of growing up. But this is interesting. They are part of the Ephrathites of Judah. Now, that word in Hebrew means fruitful, and it was used to describe the very blessed families of Israel. In other words, they were the founding, you know, the pillars of the Israeli community. These were the rich family, almost royal. They weren't, you know, obviously royal, they didn't have a king yet, but it's almost like a royal family. That's who they were. So he was rich, and if you look at where their land was, if you ever take a look at the map of where their land was, we find out later, it was choice land. I mean, it was great land. They had a lot of wealth. They probably had servants. They probably had a lot of things going on. They had the wealth to sustain themselves throughout a famine. They're the last people who should be cutting and running. But the first sign of famine, they pick up and they move to Moab, which is actually a very wicked and evil land, which we'll look about in a minute. But anyway, so they go off there. Well, how did things work out for them when they walked away from the promise and they went over to live with wickedness? Well, they entered the land of Moab and remained there, and the father dies. So far, not so good, right? He dies. And so Naomi was left with her two sons, and they took for themselves Moabite women, which they weren't supposed to do, but you know, they're living there now, so what else can they do? And the name of the first one was Orpah. Now, if you're like me and you read that, you're thinking, Oprah? Where does she show up in the Bible? You know, it's Orpah, not Oprah. But so that was the name of the first one, the oldest son. And the next one's named Ruth. Remember that name, because that's what this book's named after. So we know she's going to key in heavily in this story. And then both the sons also die. So how's it working out for you over that land where there's no famine? How's that working out? So they lived there about 10 years, and then they die as well. Now, they probably got married at a very young age. They probably left. When they left Israel, they're probably young, like about our lookout age kids. And then they would have gotten married young as well, especially since the father died, and they needed heirs. So they probably got married at 15 or 16. So let me put this at about 25, 26 in Ruth's life is about where they are right now. 25, about. Okay, so here they are, and there's the mother who's lost her father and two, and her husband and her two sons, which is must have been devastating for her. And, you know, she was bereft, which is, you know, coming from the word bereaved, so obviously it affected her very deeply. And the daughter-in-laws seem to have very good character because they stayed with her in her time of bereavement. So why do bad things happen to good people? I get asked this question, like, as a pastor, like one of the top five questions get asked. Why do bad things happen to good people? Well, usually it doesn't come that way. It comes like this. I can't believe in a God who would let bad things happen to good people. That's usually how I get it. So why do bad things happen to good people? I don't know. Why do good people leave God's promise? You know, why is that exactly? I'm not sure. You help me with that. Why did they leave to begin with? They're in the promised land. They were rich. They were blessed. And the first sign of trouble, they went running back to the world for protection, and they ran away from the promise. Here's the problem with that, is God's protection follows us in the midst of his promise. And when you walk away from God's promise, you also walk away from his protection. Saturday, I think it was just Saturday, we were shopping, and it was raining. It was Saturday? And so Victoria's been fighting a cold, so you know, I decided to be the chivalrous man, and I said, hey, you go get in the car, and I'll unload this, all these groceries. So I'm unloading the groceries, and it's raining, pelting down rain. And I get to the part where you have the empty cart, you know, and I have to take it back. And I see this guy coming up the thing with all these carts, you know, he's collecting them with that little thing that trails behind him. It's really cool. So I go, oh, good, I'll get on the choo-choo train. I'll give him, you know, the cart. And so I, like, turn around, and he, like, goes right by me like he didn't see me. I said, come on, man, you had to see me. So he goes up to collect them over there, and I have to follow him now to get him to take my cart, right? Well, my Jeep tailgate had been open, and I was under it. But as soon as I stepped out of that protection, I got drenched. I mean, really fast, right? Because as soon as you walk out from the protection, everything out there hits you. This is the same thing about God's promise. He has all kinds of promises in the Bible, but that's when you're with him. When you walk away from him, you're walking away from his protection as well. Now, I'm not saying all bad things happen because people walked out of their protection, but an astonishing amount of them do, and then we turn around and blame God for it. And so, you know, we have to understand that that's not the way God designed it. Okay, so if we try to hide our bad decisions, how are we going to do that? And I meet people who hide their bad decisions one of two ways. First of all, they blame it on God. They blame it on destiny. It's not my decision, it's destiny. Now, I grew up Presbyterian. Many of you know that. My father's a Presbyterian minister, and good Presbyterians believe in something called predestination. And that basically says that, you know, I'm not going to get into it. It's a big theological thing. But some people take predestination to mean it's kind of fatalistic. Absolutely everything that happens in your life happens for God's purpose. So all the bad things in your life actually happen because God sent them to you to work out some characteristic or something in your life. And if you don't understand it, you have to understand that Isaiah tells us that his thoughts are higher than our thoughts and his ways are higher than our ways. Someday it'll all make sense to us, but now it won't. I don't know if anybody else finds comfort in that. I grew up believing it, and I walked away from it when I started having some really bad things happen to some good people that I couldn't understand. And I started to realize we're blaming God for a lot of our decisions. And we're blaming God for a lot of things that are happening that aren't God's fault. God is just so good, I believe, at making good things out of bad that we think he must have planned it all along. And it's like, wow, if you could do this out of that, you must have been planning this forever. He's just that good at redemption. He's that good at what he does. He's very good at it. And so, but a lot of times people say, well, you know, I had a divorce. I guess God just wanted me to go through a divorce. Maybe. But I think we kind of look back at the marriage, we might see a few more reasons than God. You know, I've been through a divorce. My fingerprints are all over it. I can't blame God for that. But we have to be careful because a lot of times we just blame God and that takes us out of the mix. So then what we decide no longer matters. You see, we just do whatever we want because everything happens to us is by God's glory anyway, and he'll just take care of it all, and he'll work it all out for his good and our glory, or our good and his glory, and that'd be fine. We have to understand that our decisions matter. This is why Jesus tells you to choose. This is why, you know, choose this day who you will serve. There's all kinds of scriptures in the Bible. Jesus says choose. You have to decide. Daily, pick up the cross, follow me. You have to decide that. You have to decide to follow my commandments. You know, what you decide matters. But the other thing that happens is Christians, if they don't blame God, they blame the devil. That's the other thing. That's like the evangelical move. Well, I guess the devil's just you know, taking things from me again. Oh, that darn devil, you know. It's like, I don't know. If everything bad that happens to you is from the devil, don't you have to give him credit when good things happen then? You know, it's like, thank you, you know, thank you, devil, for letting me have this good thing and not taking it from me. It seems like a very strange theology. Do you think the very first phone call the Steelers made when they won the last Super Bowl was the Patriots saying, thank you for not making the playoffs so that we didn't have to beat you? I don't think that's how it went, right? I think they're going to take ownership of the fact that they're supposed to win that, right? Don't you think that maybe as Christians we can stop blaming the devil for everything, maybe? Okay, so most of the things in our life don't have to do with destiny or the devil. It has to do with our decisions. And if we understand that, we can start making better decisions. And that's kind of where we have to kind of get to in life, or else it's going to be a very long time before we get to where we need to be as Christians. Because if we don't own the bad decisions, we can't learn to make good decisions. We just have to be honest. You know, Jesus says he's the truth. We don't have to lie for him. It's just not necessary. All right. In Proverbs, there's this great verse. Love this verse. I want you to catch what he says here. Two things I ask of you. Do not refuse me before I die. Keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. I want you to catch what he's saying there. Keep deception and lies from me. Don't give me poverty or riches. He's saying that poverty is a lie. Poverty is deception and riches are a lie. That's what he's saying. He's saying these are just illusions. Here's what I want. He said, give me just what I need. If you give me too much, I'll forget you. If you don't give me enough, I'll probably turn to sin like stealing. So I just keep me from those deception and lies. Yeah. And so we just kind of have to realize that God's like, okay, I'm going to take care of you. And if you can keep your focus on that, then it helps us make these decisions better. Okay, back here. When a good thing takes you from God, only a bad thing will bring you back. And as I said, so many people have left this church because of good things. Do you think another good thing will bring them back? The only thing that's going to bring them back is bad things. Or to us or to anybody. And that's kind of the way we're wired. If we learn to receive everything from God, and the good things don't take us from God, then more good things can come because he knows it won't affect our relationship. Do you understand the most important thing to God isn't what you have? It's your relationship with him. He doesn't care about your stuff. It's all going anyway. He cares about your relationship. He cares about your heart. So why would he sit there and bless you with a lot of things and keep taking you away from him? Why would he do that? He wants you. He doesn't want you to have stuff. He doesn't mind blessing you. But if your blessings are taking you away, why would he keep giving them to you? It kind of makes sense if you think about that. And we walk away from God. We walked away from his protection anyway. So we're going to see these very bad things happen sometimes to people because of the situation they're in. So anyway, back to Naomi. She gets up with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the land of Moab. So I'm done here. It's not been a good place. I'm going to go home. For she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord, I love this, had visited his people and gave them food. What? The angel came and just started giving food. Like, I love how she puts this. Oh, God had taken food away, but now he's bringing up. No, God was always there in the promised land. There were people who stayed. You know, they worked the land. They made the water work, and they had food. It had nothing to do with God. Like, oh, I'm just going to give them all gifts now. More manna for everybody. No, they just farmed the lands, and it worked. But the famine was gone, so, oh, it's all plentiful there. Yeah, it would have been. Just stick it out. Stay with God. Trust him to provide. No, go running away to Moab. But that's what they did. So she says, well, I heard they have food again in Israel. So I'm going to go back. And so I'm going to go back to there. And the daughter-in-laws who live in the household, and they don't have any husbands, decide they're going to go with them. So she departs from that place. And the two daughters-in-law were with her and are walking back to the land of Judah. You know, they're heading back to Israel. Now, the two daughters-in-law have never been there. They've never been in Israel. They're Moabites. And Naomi, it's just like a curse. It turns around and says, wait a minute, why are you guys following me? It doesn't make any sense. You need to go return, each of you, to your mother's house. Go back home. You're young. May the Lord deal with you kindly because you dealt with me. She says, you've been kind to me in the middle of my bereavement. And I'm going to ask that God blesses you, but don't follow me anymore. This doesn't make any sense. May the Lord grant you that you can find rest in the house of your husband. Women, did you find rest in the house of your husband? I'm just wondering about that because I don't think my wife rests very much in the house of her husband. But then she kisses them and they lift up their voices and they weep. Like they're really sorry to see her go. And she's like, I'm going to leave now and you're going to stay here. And they said, no, we'll go with you. We'll stay with you, return to your people. And she goes, return? Why? Why would you go with me to return to Israel? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Am I going to give birth to any more kids? I don't think so. There's going to be no one who's going to marry you there. Now, according to Jewish law, by the way, if she did have sons, they would be required by law to marry them. That's why they have multiple wives, because that's the way inheritances got passed down, got man to man. And so they would have been required by law to marry them. But she said, I don't have any sons waiting for us in Israel. There's nobody there for me. This makes no sense at all. Return, my daughters. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I said I had hope, even a husband might, and I could bear sons. Are you going to wait till they grow up to become your husband? This doesn't make any sense. She's basically saying, look, I looked it all over, and this doesn't make any sense at all. My daughters, it's harder for me than you. Now watch this, for the hand of God has turned against me. Man, she went from being pleasant to being one of the biggest doomsayers you could possibly imagine.
We're all gonna die together out here. You shouldn't have come here.
It's like, yeah, it's like depressing and hopeless, and there's nothing we can do about it, right? It's done. I'm done. God's against me. God's not against her, by the way. She's reaping what she sowed. She said, I'm gonna go back and die. You know, you guys can say here. She's like turning into Eeyore from the Winnie the Pooh cartoon, right? That's what she is now. The world's logic, though, always will lead you to hopelessness. Have you noticed that? Ever sit around and watch people talking about how things are going bad? And where does it go? It's like, man, we're all doomed. We're all gonna die. It's hopeless. You know, it's depressing to sit around and talk to the wisdom of the world because they don't have any answers. It's like, yeah, I'm if you just look at it, it's just gonna get worse and worse and worse until we all die. You know, we're gonna get older but not wiser, stiffer but not more dignified. It's just, you know, it's gonna be just a mess. So you know, we have no place to go. Okay. Then they lift up their voices, they wept again, and Orpah, whom I shall ever call Oprah, kissed her mother-in-law and left. So she goes, you make good sense, Mom. I'm out. I'm still young. I'm still beautiful. I can still attract a man. I can still get married. And she goes back to where she came from. But Ruth clung to her. And Naomi's trying to talk her into leaving. Look, your sister-in-law, she's got brains. She went back. She went to her people and to her gods. Go back, worship the same place you've been coming from. Return after your sister-in-law. You need to go back, she says. Don't stay here. This doesn't make any sense at all. Just go back, right? But where is Ruth going to go? See, what Naomi did not realize, but what we can see looking into the text, is Ruth's changed. Ruth is not the same person that she was when Naomi met her. She's not the same person she was when she married her son. She's a different person now. And I don't know why, by the way. I have no idea how it happened. The Bible doesn't give us a clue. My guess is that she was sitting there in Passover, you know, which we've done the Passover, and she heard this amazing story about a God who loved the people so much that he did all that for them in Egypt. And she thought, oh, that's the God I want. You know, she just had this glimpse of the living God. And she knew the gods of Moabite. You know, she lived with them. She knew those were dead and empty gods. But she got this glimpse of the living God. And she goes, you know what? I want to be part of that. That's what I want to be. She has changed in the time that she has been married in these 10 years or whatever the past. She's not the same person, so she can't go back to the same place. Sometimes this is the choice we're making. Go back to the way it was or move forward no matter what the cost. Psalm says this, a day in your court is better than 1,000 outside. I would rather stand at the threshold of the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness. This is what Ruth caught. You know what? I may not be able to marry a Jewish boy. He may not marry me. Probably he shouldn't because she was considered Moabite. But I don't care. Get me to the threshold of the house of God. I'll stand outside of the temple of God. I just want a glimpse. I've seen a little. I want to see more. I want to see that God again. I want to see more. This God I've heard talked about. I want to be part of that. So there's no going back for her. Where did she get this kind of faith? We don't know. You know, we don't know where she got this kind of faith, but we do know this. This kind of faith is possible because we see it in the Bible. And what happens is they get a little tiny bit of truth about God revealed to them, and they believe it. And what happens is it ends up creating this desire in them for more truth. See, Paul says this, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. You move from one step of faith to another step of faith. And from faith to faith, that's how righteousness gets revealed to you. That's how you find out who God is. You take a step of faith, you take another step of faith. Our problem is we sit back and say, God, prove it to me and I'll step. God said, how about you step and I'll prove it to you? Right? That's faith. Faith's taking a step. We're saying, I'm listening. If you make a good case, then I'll do it. But I need you to prove yourself first. This is what we do. But God's saying, no, we move from faith to faith. Believe this and you'll believe the next, and you'll believe the next, and you'll believe the next. I'm going to lead you to me because you can't handle this all at once. When you discover and believe, will increase your hunger for more truth. Truth is like spiritual breadcrumb trail, and it's designed to lead you to the throne of God. That's what it's designed for. And that's how God can be a righteous judge, because the truth is all around you. Just pick one up and follow it. You'll follow it to me. And he tells us that. He says, I will be revealed to you if you just start understanding and believing truth, the things which are true around you. In Philippians, Paul says this: look, I don't mean to say I've already achieved all these things or I've already reached perfection, but here's what I'm doing. I'm pressing on to possess that perfection for which Christ Jesus first possessed me. In other words, Jesus Christ saved me for the purpose of making me perfect. That's what he's saying. And I'm not there, but I am pressing on to get there. It's not easy. That's why I love the expression, I'm not walking on, I'm not stumbling on, I'm not waiting. He's saying, I'm pressing on. I'm pushing forward to it at all times. No, but my dear brothers and sisters, I have not achieved it yet, but I focus on this one thing. Forgetting the past, looking forward always to what lies ahead, I press on to reach the end of the race to receive the heavenly prize for which God, through Jesus Christ, is calling us. This is what Ruth had. See, she had this little glimpse of truth, and she says, I don't know where this is going, but I'm going to press on. I'm going to leave everything else behind. I'm going to just keep pushing on. I'm going to keep pushing on until I can see a glimpse of his face. That's going to take me to Jerusalem. Sounds good. Let's go. I don't care where I'm going to be there. I need to get there because here's what I know. I'm not going back. There's no way, she says, I'm going back to Moab. There's no way I can. There's no way. Who were they? Why was it so evil and wicked to go back? Okay. Looking around, because last night we had a bunch of young kids in the audience. I had to kind of walk through this carefully. This is one of the sections of the Bible that's kind of icky, and you don't want to look at, but it's there. So we're going to go look at it. Here's where the Moabites came from. Do you remember the story of Lot? Those of you who grew up in CCD or Bible school or something, you kind of know the story of Lot. He was living in his land of Sodom and Gomorrah. We actually have some of those terms that still stay with us to this day. And it was an evil, wicked place, and God says, it's so evil and wicked, I'm going to destroy it. And so Abraham, who knew his nephew was there, said, wait, God, if there's righteousness there, you wouldn't do it, would you? And he says, if you could find 100 righteous people in Sodom and Gomorrah, would you not destroy it? And God says, okay. And God's just having a good time with Abraham here because he knows there's no righteousness in Sodom and Gomorrah, none. He says, okay, how about 10? Would you save it for 10? He says, sure, I'd save it for 10. And he says, well, how about one, just one? Would you save it for just one? And God says, sure, find me one. But he can't because Lot, his nephew, is no longer righteous. It started out, he's kind of camped his tent near Sodom and Gomorrah. By the time we see him later, he's the mayor of Sodom and Gomorrah, literally. He's sitting at the gate in the mayor's seat. He's become part of Sodom and Gomorrah. He's not righteous anymore. And so God, for Abraham's sake, goes in and pulls him out. He says, I'm going to destroy the city, but you and your family, go now, run, because I'm going to destroy it. And they do. They pick up everything and just grab what they can. They go running out of Sodom and Gomorrah, and they're running out. And his wife looks back. I'm really going to miss that place. You know, den of iniquity. I'm really going to miss it. And God strikes her dead on the spot, and they keep running, right? And so they end up in a cave is where they finally end up. And this is just Lot and his two daughters is all that's there. So they go up out of Zorat, and they go to the mountains, and his two daughters are with him, and he was afraid to dwell in Zorah because, you know, he came from Sodom and people didn't like them. So he and his two daughters dwelt in a cave. Now, here's the problem. They're going to go back to Abraham. Israel as a nation doesn't exist yet, but Abraham's there, and Abraham's rich. But the problem is these two daughters aren't going to get any of that because they don't have husbands and they don't have children, and there's no way of them getting any of Abraham's inheritance. So what they're looking at is a situation where if we end up back at Abraham and money's being passed out, we get nothing. What we need are heirs. But they're in a cave with their dad. There's no way they're going to get heirs. So they come up with a plan to get him drunk so he doesn't know what he's doing and have relations with them so they will get pregnant and they have heirs. And guess what? It worked. They took two nights, lots of booze. They made it happen, and I want you to see the two heirs that get born, two sons, just like they wanted, they ended up coming out, and they formed the Moabites and the Ammonites. They had two sons. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab, and he's the father of Moabites to this day. So this is the heritage of Moab. They were made through an incestuous relationship of their father. So that's why God looks at them and says, that's a wicked and evil place. And it's nothing, I see nothing but evil and wickedness there, because it's not like these people ever repented and came back. They were proud of their heritage, right? They were survivors. They did what they had to do. So anyway, Ruth was born a Moabite. She has absolutely no hope of salvation. None. And I can prove that because God so was displeased with them and the Ammonites who came from the other son that he actually put a law in Deuteronomy and said, no Ammonite or Moabite shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord. You're not allowed in. You're not allowed at all. Even to the 10th generation, none of the descendants will ever enter the assembly of the Lord forever. Moabites aren't allowed in. But she got grafted into the Israelites. See, this is what the thing is. She says, I'm not a Moabite anymore. I'm an Israelite. See, I'm no longer that person. And so she tells Naomi, says, look, don't make me leave you. Don't make me turn back from following after you. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God shall be my God. Because she's saying, if I have to serve you to make it, I'll serve you. Don't treat me as a daughter, I'll be your servant. Listen, oftentimes our path to knowing God better is through service to others. This is kind of why we have a blue-collar Savior. Right? It's all about serving others. And she realized that, and she was okay with that. She said, I'll be a servant. I'll go begging in the streets for you. I'll do it for you. I'll do whatever it takes because I need for your God to be my God. She caught a glimpse of that. She goes, I'm not going back to Moabites. I was a Moabite. Now I'm a child of living God. You think I'm giving up on that? You think that I care about how much stuff I have here that would make me give up that? No, it's not going to happen. I'm not giving this up. It was a miracle that I am in the family of Israel. I am not walking away from that miracle. You know, Naomi should listen to this because Naomi walked away from her promise when things got a little bit tough. Ruth's saying, I'm never walking away from this promise. You can't make me. No one can. I'll do whatever it takes. I'll be a beggar. I don't care. I'm going to go to Israel. I'm going to be part of the Israelites. I'm no longer a Moabite. We have to get this identity. And we say, I can't go back to this sin because I'm no longer that person, right? I am now a child of the living God. I'm not going back. I'm going forward. I don't care what forward looks like. I know what back looks like. I came from there. I'm not going back there. I'm going forward. She says, I want to go. I want your God to be my God. That's what I want. More than anything else, that's all I want. If I never marry again, okay. If I never have kids, okay. If I'm a beggar, okay. If I have to sit outside and listen about God from the open door, I will do that. I'm not walking away from the promise. It's just not going to happen. Now, I got to sum up here real quick, but I got to show you this because this we're coming to Christmas here, right? So, and remember every Christmas they talk about the lineage of Jesus and you follow it. Let me show you this. This is Matthew 1:1. This is the lineage of Jesus. I'm going to show you, kind of spoiler alert, how Ruth ends up. And hopefully it gets you all inspired to come back and listen to her story. So the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ. So Abraham begets Isaac. Isaac begets Jacob, and Jacob begets Judah and his brothers, okay? God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We know that. But watch what happens down the line. Salmon begot Boaz by Rahab. Some of you were here when we talked about that. We know who Rahab is, right? Boaz begot Obed by Ruth. And Obed begets Jesse, and Jesse begets David, the king. Ruth is King David's great-great-grandmother, his great-grandmother. Isn't that amazing? See, she didn't give up on the promise. So we know she's going to end up a beggar, right? But she not only doesn't end up a beggar, God sees the heart. God sees his heart coming after him. You think he's going to turn her away at the door? No, he brings her all the way in because this means that she's also part of the lineage of Jesus Christ. How's that for a Moabite? That's turning yourself all the way around, isn't it? But she says, I'm not letting go. That's who I was. This is who I am. Whatever it takes, your God will be my God. She made a decision and she followed it through. She didn't care what it cost. And she ends up to become lineage of Jesus Christ himself. Her name is remembered 3,000 years after she did all this. And if we hadn't that little time to think about Orpah, you wouldn't know who she was. She disappears from the annals of history. Ruth is still here. See, it's amazing to us when we decide to choose God. What happens? And we come and we say, okay, I've chosen you. And then you come to God and you find out he's been waiting for you. You know, it's like you thought it was just something that just happened. He goes, no, I've been waiting for your arrival since the beginning of time. God always knew who Ruth was going to be in the lineage of Jesus. Always knew. That's why he drew her out of the Moabites to begin with. That heart was that special to him. The question is, what life-defining choices are going to hit you in 2018? And more importantly, when they do, how will you choose? Would you please pray with me?